This is Extraordinary Lives, a podcast from Lad Bible where we speak to people with a unique story to tell. A warning that this episode contains discussion of suicidal feelings which you may find distressing. I'm Ben Powell Jones, and coming up in this episode...
They tried to shoot him, but the gun didn't work, apparently. And then somebody put a knife into Reggie's hands. But he'd had a lot to drink. He was on tablets, on Purple Hearts, and... Gin, just totally off the wall. We all went down.
And you went down for murder?
I went down for murder, yeah. I've got right. 15 years.
Hello and welcome to Extraordinary Lives, the podcast from Lad Bible. I'm Ben Powell-Jones and we're joined in the studio today by Chris Lambriano. It's great to have you here, Chris.
It's nice to be here, Ben.
For anyone who isn't aware of who you are, would you mind giving a brief introduction?
Yeah, I've got many roles. I'm a father... I'm a brother, I'm an uncle, I'm a friend. But I was arrested with the Cray brothers in 1967 and I was sentenced to 15 years for murder. Hmm. And it's something you can't get away from. When you do that kind of time, a man can get in a ring for 15 rounds, but it's over in a night. 365 days a year for 15 years, and you never know when the day comes you're going to get out or if you're even going to get out because you're in hell. And I share my story in the hope that nobody will travel down that road as I travel down it. I looking back, I would say that, you know, there's so many other roads that you can travel that might be a bit harder. You have to work harder, you'll have to put more effort in, but it's worth it. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you'll see the rewards. Mm. You know, just don't give up.
Understood. And, you know, it's a great message. When we get to the end of your story, I guess we'll hear how you came to that thought process. Yeah. But for now, let's go back to the beginning of it. You know, where did you start out? What was early life?
I'm somebody who came up in the just after the war. Mm. I mean, I can still remember going down Good Street Underground when the bombs were dropping and the sirens were going and stuff like that. And then we got evacuated up to Ibstock in Leicester.
Right, so what year were you born, Chris?
I was 1938.
Wow, okay.
And at Ibstock in Leicester, my dad used to repair the Spitfires and the airfields. And I always thought, as a little kid being put up in an aeroplane and sitting in a pilot's seat, that's what I'd have loved to have done. Mm-hmm. But circumstances are different. We was up there and then we moved back to London and there was a lot of upheaval for everybody. I mean, the East End, the West End, no matter where you look, everywhere was devastated. Bomb sites and everything. Wonderful for kids to go and play in and throw bricks around and pull down buildings and stuff like that. I mean, life was what it was. Mm. Enjoy it. That's our attitude. But the fact was, I mean, it was highly dangerous at the time. If you walk on a building site now, you've got to wear a yellow hat. In them days, you didn't have nothing. Mm. We were kids just having fun.
And was a sense at that time that England was back in a state of, like, growth and prosperity again after the war, or was it very much a sense of, like,
poverty.
Poverty.
Right. I mean, everything was rationed. Bananas, fruit, sweets. You know, whatever it was, you had to have a ration book. But we moved to a place called 45 Howland Street, which is just under the post office tower. And there were every kind of character you could imagine. Prince Monolulu, I've got a horse. There was Yorkie, a guy who had an awesome car, used to go around collecting junk. And we'd go with him on his journey round, picking up old bits of iron, and because it was scrap stuff was everywhere. And then from there, I went to school down at in St Patrick's in Soho, and Catholic school. But I somehow didn't fit in because it wasn't like today when you go to school, you've got an education, teachers knew you and everything else. It was upheaval. No matter, move from this place to that place. We finished up in a workhouse over in South London. And then from the surf, from the workhouse in South London, we moved to the halfway house in Victoria. And the way of earning a shilling when we moved there was me and my brother used to go and carry suitcases from the coach station in Victoria down to the train station. And they'd give us a shilling or sixpence or whatever. And we could go and buy different things we needed. So there was no problem with doing hard work. I mean, it was what it was. And then we moved to the East End. But the East End was a different kettle of fish. You know, I mean, racism was pretty bad. I can remember going to one house and they had a party there. And the lady of the house said, don't bring the Greek kid in. But I heard it and I felt it, you understand? I'm a kid, I want to belong. I want to be friends, I want to be running, playing football, I want to get out there, I want to build bum sites, climb and do whatever. I don't want to be shut out. I've done nothing wrong, I'm a human being. And that kind of attitude destroyed me a little bit.
So were you a sensitive kid?
Yeah, I was, yeah. I was sensitive to that kind of thing. And as I said, then we moved into the East End and I went with some kids and we stole some lead off of Ruth and I got sent to an approved school, Basil Enriquez at Toynbee Hall, which is just round the corner, strangely enough. I went in front of him and he sent me to an approved school.
And what's an approved school?
Approved school was where you sent the naughty kids.
Right.
Where more or less what they said was that your parents couldn't control you, you were out of your parents' control. And so they sent you there to learn lessons. Well, when I went there, I went to school for maybe about 6 months and then they put me to work out in the fields, carrots, picking carrots, lettuces.
How old were you here?
I would be about 12 and a half, 13.
Wow. Okay.
And I stayed there till I was 15. And then I came out of there and went home, but it wasn't long before I got myself into more trouble. And then I found myself in a borstal. But then what I was doing was getting into crime, getting to meet all the characters from all over England. Because strange as it may seem, you know, there ain't many people you don't know. If you're in prison, they come from Liverpool, Manchester, Birmingham, Devon, Cornwall, all over the place. So you're connected up in all them different places. And so I did the approved school and then I came out and I went in the army.
Right.
And as a national serviceman. And I went in grade two, so I went in the Pioneers. And because I'd got a perforated eardrum, I was a boxer in the borstal. And they, I went in grade two and they put me in a regiment in Wales, Pioneer Corps. And it wasn't for me. I'd already done 3 years in a borstal. I had all the discipline I needed and I just wanted to get out of there. And I'd go and see a psychiatrist and they turned around and said, no, you know, people who've done your kind of approved school, borstal, that kind of thing, you make good MPs. Would you consider, you know, going into that kind of thing? I said, no, I wouldn't. You know, I just want to go home. I want to get a job and do everything right. And so that's what happened. I went back home and it all went pear-shaped again. And I went away to prison.
So why did you go the second time to prison?
The second time I got done for blowing a safe.
Right.
In a post office. And in Stoke Newington, that was. And so I got 2 years and I did the 2 years and I came out and I went looking for work, but I didn't fit in anywhere.
Mm. And were you, at that point in time, were you attracted by crime or was it just a mean to an end?
It was a means to an end.
Yeah.
All the way through my life of crime, all I wanted to do was earn enough to go straight. Because I know that, you know, there is no value in crime. You've got something now, but you haven't got it tomorrow.
Mm.
You know, it's like gone. You spend it on this, you spend it on that. Oh, I've got to have that, I've got to have this, I've got to have that. Do you really need it? No, you don't. But you can invest in yourself. But not only that, if one thing now, I'm 85 years of age, the one thing I can't buy is time.
Mm.
It don't matter if I was a multimillionaire, if whatever, I can't go and buy any time, extra time. I've got what I've got. Could be today, could be tomorrow, could be 10 years from now. I'm just grateful for every day.
Mm.
And so, and you know, I did the first half of my life till I came out of prison when I was 42.
Right, okay.
So my sentence finished. I did the 15 years, the full 15 years. And then I came out and I wanted change. I wanted what I'd lost.
So what was the 15 years for?
Murder.
So let's jump back a little bit then.
Yeah,
and then
yeah,
and let's
yeah,
get
certainly Ben, yeah.
No, that's okay. So you did the you went to prison for blowing the safe in the post
yeah,
office.
That's right, yeah.
You came out from that.
Yeah.
And then was it a case that you then immediately got back into the same sort
of... Yes, I did, yes, straight away.
Criminal...
Yeah, because I didn't know anything else, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
That's the life I knew.
Yeah.
That's the culture that I'd been brought up in, the prison culture. As I said, meeting people from all over the country. And so in many respects, that I didn't consider anything else.
Mm.
That's all I saw, that crime was going to be a way out.
And what kind of crime was it you were doing? Was it just anything that came
along? It was anything
way,
that came along. Right. Like I said, if you're connected and we say you're a pavement artist. Now, a pavement artist is a man goes out on a blag. They go out, they've got harmonia or they've got a what's the name, a shooter or whatever, and it's a wage snatch. Then you come away from there. You may be lucky, you may get 4 or 5 grand or whatever, but you've got away with it and you've got a good name in that circle that you can be trusted, you'll do your work properly and, you know, you'll hold up, you won't go to pieces. And then they'll tell somebody else and they've got a bit of work going, well, you're interested in this. But it wasn't something I really enjoyed, to be honest with you.
And what would you have done anything for money at that point?
Or at that time, I would have done anything for money.
Yeah.
And I went up to Birmingham. I was on the run. And whilst up there, I went to a nightclub and there was a bit of a fight going on. And I jumped in to help this guy. And he turned out to be one of the best long firm men in the country. Well, what long firms are is they open up a company and they get lines of credit everywhere where they pay the credit. So they build up a good reputation with these companies. And then they go and say, look, we need this. That may be 20,000, that may be 15,000, that may be 10,000. And they get the goods, which they don't pay for. And then they sell them all and shut the office up and everything.
Right.
I mean, the offices might be in Great Portland Street. Maybe in Good Street, it may be in Piccadilly, it may be anywhere. You can hire an office anywhere. And that basically is what the long firm is. And so, but it, the other thing as well, there was also protection.
Mm.
Now, people think that you walk into a pub or you walk into an off-licence or a sweet shop and demand money with menaces, I'm protecting you. It don't work like that.
Mm.
They come to you.
Oh, really?
And say, look, we've got a problem. Somebody's given us some grief. We're being threatened or whatever. And you go and sort it out. And the people you're talking to, they know you mean business. And so consequently, they leave the person alone. They don't need any grief. All they want to do is be able to go and get some money and go and do whatever they want to do. And so that's the way the craze got involved in all the different things. People went to them. They didn't go bashing people up and all that kind of stuff. It's, the pornographic industry in Soho, I mean, all that, they had problems with different people, threatening them and everything else, like going to smash their shops up. And you went and sorted it out and they were happy.
So they the people with the businesses would be threatened by people, and yeah, they'd go actively to the craze.
To the craze, or go to whoever. And there wasn't only the craze, there were firms that you don't even know about.
Mm.
But they were more honourable. Mm. They kept things to themselves. They're quiet. These people didn't even let their wives know what they were doing.
Mm.
Because if the police had any idea that they were up to something, they'd go and pull the wife in and want to know this, that and the other, threaten to take the kids off them and everything else like that. So a man never told his wife.
Mm.
He never told people any more than they needed to know. That was old school. And you looked out for each other. And so, you know, it was, and I was doing okay in Birmingham. You know, I had my own car pitch. I was earning money. I was respected. I gambling had just taken off up there. The car industry, it was unlike London. London was rip-off. No matter what it was, if you wanted an ice cream, you're going to pay three times as much as you pay in a shop. Where in Birmingham, everything was normal. It was the same. You went to a nightclub, you had a good night out, no problems. People just went out, they're working hard. They worked in the car industry and what have you. And gambling took off. And people didn't want people kicking off and smashing up their casinos and what have you. So you looked out for people and they looked out for you. And that's the way it worked.
And were you, at that point in time, when you said you had your own car pitch, was that a legitimate business at that point?
It was legitimate business. I had a car pitch, but I also had a car wash as well.
Right. So you'd sort of gone straight at that point?
I was going straight.
Going straight.
But what I used to do was come down and see my dad.
Mm.
I lost my mum. She was quite young. And you can't even imagine what a family can feel until they've lost a loved one, like a mother who loves them and they've felt it. And it's like taking the captain of the ship away. This person who makes the cakes on a Sunday dinner, proper roast dinner, and then like makes the cakes for later on with sit at a table. People don't sit at a table anymore. It's all that looking at a phone and all the rest of it. They talk to the phone more than they talk to their brother, sister or father. And so we live in a very strange world. But it was rapidly going that way, you understand what I'm saying? That things were taking over. And so, you know, when I lost my mum, she went up for the first holiday in her life. My mum worked as an office cleaner of an evening, so she'd work from, say, 7 in the evening till maybe 2 or 3 in the morning with my sister-in-law in the city. So, you know, she went away for the first holiday and passed away. And you just don't know how to cope with that.
Mm.
You're off the rails. You don't believe in nothing. You try to get your head around it. But why would a loving God, why would somebody who, you know, created somebody and prepared that person in that family, take them away when you need them more than ever? She was the one kind of, you know, stabilising factor in our lives. And so, you know, that sent me off the rails quite a bit.
And how old were you here?
I was about 27,
okay,
26. And what happened then was that I used to come down and see my dad was okay every couple of weeks. And I came down to see him this week, and he was okay and we enjoyed the company. And I went back up to Birmingham and I followed him Friday. I was in the Dolls Club and there was a guy called Ray Mills there. And he said, Chris, he said, are you going down to London this weekend? I said, no. He said, Chris, look, come down. He said, I've never met your brother. You've never met mine. Let's have a meet up and we'll have a good time. And I went, no, Ray, I was down last week. I'll go down next weekend. Please, Chris. And somehow or other, you know, you think to yourself, well, I don't do it all the time. I'll go down again this week. And it was the worst move I ever made because I went down there. I got in touch with my brother Tony and we met the Mills brothers and we went out for a drink and we finished up in Wapping. From Wapping, we went over to the pub on the Bethnal Green Road and twins were there, the Craigs were there.
Was that the first time you'd seen
them? No, I'd met them before that.
Okay. Was your brother involved with them?
My brother was involved. I never knew he was involved with
right.
them. Because what was happening down here, I really weren't interested. Right. I was more interested in my life up there.
Okay.
And I remember going, I'd meet a guy called Connie Whitehead down at the Blind Beggar, and he didn't turn up. And consequently, I went to get a bus because my car was in the garage getting serviced. And a guy called Ronnie Bender came by and he said, Chris, what are you doing here? I said, well, I was supposed to meet somebody in the Beggar and they're not turned up. I'm catching the bus home. He said, come on, I'll give you a lift. And he gave me a lift home and, yeah, thanks very much, Ron. Nice to see you again. And he was an ex-soldier, ex-SAS, you know, really strong-minded character, no criminal record or anything else like that. And I kind of admired him because he was a strong man, and he'd come out of the army, been a regular soldier. And about an hour later, a knock on the door, it was Ronnie Bender. I said, yeah, Ron, what can I do? He said, the twins want to see you. I said, Ronnie, I don't want to see them. If you're short of a few quid, I'll help you out, but no. Because you knew what they were. They were trouble, you understand what I'm saying? The grief they caused and everything else like that. So you didn't want to...
Were they famous at that point?
Yeah, they were famous. Well, they were kind of famous. Everybody knew who they were. And people knew that, you know, if somebody had gone and committed a robbery, they'd want their little corner of it.
Right.
And things like that. You understand?
And were they, in terms of the criminal underworld at that point in time, were they intimidating characters or were they just other characters?
No, they were quite intimidating right. characters, yeah. And so, you know, Chris said, Tony's down there. And I couldn't say no.
Tony's your brother?
Yeah, and I went down there and perfectly polite. Hello, Chris, nice to meet you. I understand you're up in Birmingham. Reason we wanted to see you, we want a favour. And I said, what's that? They said, well, we've opened a club in Birmingham, in Leicester, and Charlie's running it. And we wonder whether you could bring some people over to gamble at our place. It's a nicely run club. We'd like to go and have a look at it, assess it, and then decide if you want to bring some punters over. So I said, I'd do my best. And
Charlie's the older brother, right?
Charlie was the older brother.
Less famous in the general pop culture. But
very amicable, very, very kind of, how can I put it, sociable, non-threatening or anything else like that. Right. Really decent old boy. And so the fact was I went back and I went over, I had a look at the club. I was quite impressed with it. And I took some people over there. And they were pleased. And so other people brought other people over there. So, yeah, it was all about, you know, bringing the club to the notice of other people. Mm. And, yeah, it was okay. Then I got to know them a little bit better. And how can I put it? They wanted you to do things, mainly because I weren't... Mm-hmm. Under the radar. And so a couple of things I did I wasn't happy about. And
can you go into them or not?
Well, one of them was they had a problem with a co-owner of a club. And could you go and wake him up, Chris? So I don't know nothing about the guy, but I've got his address. I know where he lives in Coventry. And I went round there Sunday morning. I got a dustbin and I threw it through the window. And I couldn't see who was in the room or anything, the curtains and that. And there's a man and a woman and two young children sitting there having breakfast. Knocked me sideways. Mm. I wouldn't have liked anybody to do that to me. I certainly wouldn't have done that had I known what was occurring in that room. And I wanted away from... but going back to the night, you know, that night we went to the pub and then went on to the... I wanted to go to West End. And Tony said, let's go to the Regency Club. And we went to the Regency against my best wishes, because Saturday night was a Saturday night gangster night. Everybody comes out, all the working lads, you know, want to be tough and all the rest of it, impress the girls. And so you stay away, let them get on with it. And the West End was a better place to go. And anyway, we went there, general invitation to a party, went round, and we went to the party. I couldn't get my car out, and we went in Jack the McVitie's car.
And he was a famous character in that scene, wasn't he? Or he is now.
He is now. He wasn't then. I mean,
right.
Jack was a fun guy, you understand what I mean? It's all right, people making him a villain and this nasty person, but that wasn't a Jack I knew, you understand what I'm saying? It's convenient to paint him like that, because then it doesn't make the perpetrators of his demise bad people, you understand what I mean? They got rid of a nasty piece of work. But he had his differences with them, and I didn't know their business or anything else like that. And so we go to the party. Jack runs in the room. Where's the girls? Where's the music? And all the rest of it. People are dancing and what have you. And the next thing, a fight starts.
Between who?
Between Jack and Reggie.
Right. So you'd gone to this party on this night, and the Cray Twins were in the party.
Yeah, that's right.
Previous to that, Jack and the Cray Twins had issues with each other.
But nobody knew it. I'd seen them the previous week. I'd seen Jack with Reggie and everything was fine.
Right.
And Jack came and sat down with us. He said, I'm back on the firm. I said, didn't even know you was on it.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, I weren't that connected to them.
Yeah.
To know what their business was, who was with them, who wasn't with them. And so, you know, it was what happened.
So you were based in Birmingham and you were doing the odd job for them.
That's right.
Kind of favours.
Yeah, that's right.
And you'd come down for this night out and you'd gone to this party.
I never earned any money from them.
Oh, right, really?
No. The only time they ever gave me anything was Ronnie gave me a watch, which he'd bought from Watches of Switzerland in Piccadilly. And it was a Waltham. I admired it and he gave it to me. He was that kind of man. If you liked something and he felt you'd kind of done them a turn, it'd give you something. You understand what I'm saying? Anyway, the bottom line was that I didn't expect nothing of them. Mm. When I did that favour to go around the house, I never expected that.
So why would you do those things?
Because they wanted rid of the guy. He was a partner in the club.
But why would you do them a favour if you wouldn't get anything, I guess, is what
But you they do you favours, you do them favours.
Okay.
What goes around comes around.
Got it.
You understand what I mean? Do. You never know when you're going to need them and they don't know when you're going to need you.
So they're good friends to have at that
point. That's right.
Yeah.
So that was what happened. And so I leave the party and...
Okay, going back. So you've gone into the party, this fight's broken
and
out.
I'll see what happens. I don't want to be part of it. I've had a lot of drink. All I want to do is go. Mm. And Ronnie Cray comes out and he said, what's the matter? And I said, I didn't come down here for this. And he said to Connie Whitehead, take him home. And Connie Whitehead took me home, said, Chris, don't go back there. I went in, I had a cup of coffee with my dad, sobered up a little bit. And I thought, well, my car is up at the Regency. I've got to go and get that. So I went up. I got my car from outside the Regency Club. And I drove around to Reverend Road thinking I'm going to pick Tony up. I don't know what's gone on.
Your brother again, Tony.
My brother, yeah. I knock at the door and Ronnie Bender comes to the door. And I said, is Tony there? He said, no, he's gone. I said, right, Ron, I'll see you later. I went to walk away. He said, don't leave me. I said, what do you mean, don't leave you? He said, they've killed him. I said, killed who? He said, they've killed Jack. No, I said, not in front of all them people, in front of all them witnesses. I couldn't see the possibility of it. You can't do that kind of thing.
Mm.
You understand? Because you're not only dropping yourself in it, but all the people are there. There must have been about 7 or 8 people there. So it was, and Blanc Carroll could come back any time. who owned the house. She wasn't there. Anyway, I went in, and this is a soldier. I'm talking about a regular soldier. A man you could respect. And I went in, we walked downstairs, and there lying in the by the fire was a body. And I looked and I thought, he's going to wake up any minute. I can't believe that there's a dead man there.
This episode of Extraordinary Lives is brought to you by BetterHelp. Now, sometimes in life we face tough choices. Those choices can make it difficult to know the best path forward. You might be dealing with decisions around your career, relationships, friendships, or something else. Whatever it is, therapy can help you stay connected with the world around you whilst you navigate through a more challenging period. We've worked with BetterHelp since starting this podcast, and it's always led us to talking about therapy amongst the team. It's something that often doesn't come up in daily conversation, but it's been clear that so many of us have benefited from it. Therapy isn't exclusively for people who've experienced major trauma. It's a really useful way of learning positive coping skills, how to set boundaries, and improve how you feel about yourself and where you are in life. So, if you're thinking about starting therapy, a good way to get into it is BetterHelp. BetterHelp is entirely online, so it's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a quick questionnaire and you'll be matched with a licensed therapist. If you're not clicking for whatever reason, you can switch therapists at any time. To try, visit betterhelp.com/minuteswith to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/minuteswith. Now back to the show.
Was that your first time seeing a dead body?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Right.
And I just thought, no, he's gonna get up. And then you realise he's not. And so I went upstairs and into a bedroom, and I went to get an eiderdown because you can't, we've got to move that body.
Yeah.
And I take it downstairs. But what I noticed, there were two children asleep in the bedroom upstairs. Blonde Carol had gone to another party with her boyfriend George, leaving the two babies there in the care of the twins. Can you imagine it? But killing somebody and there's two babies upstairs, whether they knew they were there, I don't know. That's the jumble of it all, Ben. You understand what I'm saying? It wasn't, there's nothing sane about the whole thing. It was just totally off the wall, crazy. Anyway, what happened then was...
How had he been killed?
He'd been knifed to death.
Wow.
Stabbed to death.
Wow, so like multiple times?
Yeah, multiple times.
God.
Apparently, when I was, I'd gone, somebody, and the gun didn't work, somebody went and got a knife out of the kitchen.
So they tried to shoot him?
They tried to shoot him, but the gun didn't work, apparently. And then somebody put a knife into Reggie's hands. But he'd had a lot to drink. He was on tablets, on Purple Hearts, and gin, just totally off the wall. And so I go upstairs, I get the eiderdown, we go downstairs, I put McVitie's body on the eiderdown and wrap the eiderdown around him, and I go in the kitchen, I get some socks, because our dabs are fingerprints, are going to be all over the place. And so I gave him a pair of socks, Ronnie Bender, and I had a pair, and we put them on, and we had a right tidy up.
Put them on your hands.
Yeah. And in the meantime, there's a knock on the door. Go upstairs, Ronnie Bender, he comes back down, his Tony's with him. Tony's come back looking for me. He's gone to Reese, he's looking for the car. My car ain't there. He's come back down to Everham Road knowing I'd look for him. And so now he's involved up to his eyeballs. He helps us. We get the place all tidied up. Another knock on the door. Blonde Carol and George have come back. Where's the planning? Come on, this isn't Agatha Christie. This isn't kind of, you know, Stephen King kind of stuff. This is what it is. Total... If there's a comedy of errors, there's a tragedy of errors. And this was the tragedy of errors. But it's only just beginning. So I tell Carol, look, go in the bedroom, and because there's been a bit of an altercation, things are being sorted out and everything's okay. She's in there. We get the body upstairs in the hallway. But Faison is an all-night place where people go and buy their bagels, the cab drivers and stuff like that. So we've got to wait until there's a clear, and no taxis are there, so we can get the body out and get it into McVitie's car. You can't get a six-foot man into the boot of a car. So we got him on the back seat. But I asked Ronnie Bender what his instructions were. And he said that the twins had told him to get the body, carry it up to a railway bridge, which was about 100 yards away, and throw it over the railway bridge. And the train would mash it up. It just gets worse and worse and worse.
And when you say they were his instructions for disposing of the body,
yeah,
was it normal that the Krays would carry out acts like that? Or would they usually have people that would do them for them?
No, there was nothing ever professional in any of their killings when you think about it. I mean, George Cornell, to walk into a pub in front of a... I mean, I didn't even know him when that happened, but they walked into a pub and the next thing you know, they shoot a man dead in front of a barmaid, in front of other staff, in front of people enjoying their pint. And the next thing you know, and walk out like nothing's happened on earth and thinking everybody's going to keep quiet. And they did for a period of time. But eventually, it starts leaking out.
Mm.
And so, you know, that was another senseless one.
So for you at that point in time, would you have described yourself, based on where your life was at that point in time, would you have described yourself as a violent person? Were you involved in a lot of violence?
No, if something was personal, it was personal.
Right. So was this quite a shocking thing for you?
It was for me, yeah.
This wasn't business as usual.
Because it didn't... This isn't business.
Yeah.
This is madness.
Mm.
It's what you don't do, Ben. You understand what I mean? If you can read any crime book you want, you can read about the mafia, you can read about Colombian crime. They don't do this kind of thing.
Mm.
They don't put themselves on offer.
So why would the Krays?
You're asking me that. They love the publicity.
Wow.
They wanted it out there. You understand what I'm saying? They wanted it out in the world.
The infamy, the reputation.
The infamy and everything. They had a man writing the book during the time of their arrest and everything else like that. It couldn't have come together. But what a waste of two human lives.
Mm.
Because they wasn't all bad. I mean, they had some good qualities. You understand me?
Mm.
They had some caring qualities. They loved their mum. But just not enough to stay out of prison. Not enough so she didn't have to go and visit them year after year after year and watch them slowly dying. And that's what they did. All three died in prison. Is it a successful organisation? Did they sit in a boardroom at the Hilton or wherever? Did they do Lad Bible and have an office and everything else like that? And people sat down and talked and discussed and found ways forward and put ideas to each other? No, they didn't. It had to be what they wanted, their way. And their way was total destruction. And look where it got them at the end of the day.
Okay, so they'd ordered for the body to be thrown off the bridge.
But it didn't.
But it didn't. And why didn't that happen?
So what happened was that we decided, and the three of us, that we take the body over the other side of the water. So the what had happened didn't happen in the East End.
Mm.
Happened in South London. Mm. It couldn't go on the Richardsons or them because they were all gone away. They were in prison. So we could put it over there and it could be anybody. He was over there, he got drunk, he had a row or whatever. It definitely didn't happen in the East End. The Krays never thought about that. We thought about that.
Mm.
And that's what we did. We took it through the tunnel and over the other side of the tunnel, it ran out of petrol, the car, outside a church.
Oh, wow.
Confetti on the pavement and everything else where there'd been a wedding on that Saturday. And I thought it couldn't happen a better place because if the people had come out of the church and maybe someone look in the car and the body will be found and it'll all come to light that something happened over in South London.
Yeah.
I looked in the paper the next day, nothing. I looked in the paper again, nothing. For that week, nothing happened. There was no, and I found that strange.
Mm.
But according to, you know, people's stories and everything else, because everybody's told the story, they got in touch with certain people and asked them to remove it. And more people were involved.
So you'd left the body in the car outside the church.
Yeah.
And they then subsequently got in touch with the people.
They knew where it was.
Right.
We didn't tell them. I think Ronnie Bender told them,
right.
Or told Charlie. And Charlie got in touch with them. And it had been left on somebody else's manor.
Right.
And it was a danger to the person or the people where it was. So it had to be got rid of. And that's what happened.
Okay.
And the body to this day has never been found.
Is that right?
That's right.
So it was just removed, taken away and buried or disposed of?
Or whatever.
Or whatever, okay.
Dropped out of sea or it could be anything. Nobody knows.
Okay.
Only the people involved know. How can they be that, how can I put it, that thoughtful, but then it wasn't them, was it?
Mm.
It was somebody else who had to make the decision what happened to that body. You understand me?
Mm-hmm.
Because if it was them, they'd have, some crazy thing would have happened. There'd have been a car crash or there'd have been something else. Or maybe I chucked over him on a railway line. I just don't know. Because none of it makes any sense. Mm. You can't rationalise it. So at the end of the day, the police arrested all the Cray firm.
So how did the police know?
Didn't arrest me.
But how did they know to start arresting the Crays?
But what happened was, it was Nipper Reed, he'd been after him at period one time, apparently.
He was a police officer.
He was Inspector Reed in charge of the case. And he began to look into things and he began to talk to members of their firm. And he made one or two threats, but also offered to give them help and what have you, if they helped him. And of course, one or two of them relented. And it weren't one or two, it was a lot. And so that's what happened. He built a case up and he was looking at three cases. One was the McVitie, one was the Cornell, and one was the Mitchell murder. Mm. Mitchell was a friend of theirs. They got him out of jail. Now, I'll ask you a question.
Mm.
If you get a friend out of jail, if you can't do no more for him, you let him go and do whatever he has to do. He stands on his own two feet. You don't kill him. But that's what happened. You know, is that believable?
Sounds chaotic.
It sounds chaotic. What does the Cornell murder sound like?
Mm.
What's the McVitie murder like?
Mm.
Chaotic, all the way let down the line.
So you, the kind of the image in popular culture that's been passed on and sort of created about the Cray twins now is kind of, you know, East End, Honour Amongst Thieves, Robin Hood style gangsters.
Yeah, that's right.
The picture that you're painting at the moment is quite different to that. It sounds,
it's the truth.
Yeah. It sounds quite sort of, yeah, chaotic and... it sounds like
madness. The evidence is there in itself. And when you actually look at the kind of, you look at the arrests and you have a look at the murders themselves.
Yeah.
Is it sensible or is it mafioso style to go and take a man or go to a party in front of a room full of people, kill him? How can you get away with it?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's going to be a weak link there somewhere.
Mm.
They're going to tell somebody who's going to tell somebody who's going to tell somebody tell somebody. And their life was one of paranoia. They didn't trust anybody.
Mm.
But why? Because of their own self. Most of the firms in London, and I knew most of them, they were solid. They were ring-fenced. They didn't let anybody in. They kept things to themselves. They went and did something. It was done. They walked away. Nothing was said. You understand what I'm saying? They were professionals.
Well, I suppose, as you describe, the fact that the McVitie body has never been found.
That's right.
Which was organised by a different firm.
Different firm.
And that's then stayed secret.
And the fact that the body was moved from the house, away from the scene of the crime, onto another manor, speaks to itself. Yeah. Somebody else.
Yeah.
Give some thought to it.
So when they started to be... So Nipper Reed, the detective who was trying to
pursue
the craze, he spoke to members of their firm and they basically started to give up the fact that the twins had murdered Jack McVitie.
Well, that's... No, the Cornell.
Right, okay, yeah.
Because he got into the barmaid.
Right.
Who said she didn't know, nothing had happened, she didn't understand it. But according to what I'd heard... she was threatened that her children would be taken off of her and all the rest of it.
Right, okay.
Or she could have a safe house.
Right.
And she should have chosen a safe house.
Mm.
And that's exactly what she did.
Mm.
And she gave evidence. And then other names came into it and so on and so forth. And Nipper Reed began to build a picture up of it all. They didn't know nothing about me. I weren't on the radar.
Were you nervous?
No, I wasn't, because I thought they were sensible people.
Mm.
I thought that they control situations and all that. But when I look at it all, they had no control over nothing, you know. And the people around them didn't have any control. Everything just came apart. Their own cousin stood and pointed the finger at them. He was the one who went and got the knife and put it in Reggie Cray's hands. Did he serve one day in prison? No, he didn't. He went away.
So what led up to you being arrested then?
So what led up to me to be arrested was I was in Birmingham and the police, I was going down to a place called the Elbow Room and all of a sudden I was surrounded by police cars. And they took me to a Snow Hill police station and... there for a period of time. They then, something funny happened. That afternoon, I'd met a young lady and we got invited to a house and it turned out to be one of the chief inspectors of Birmingham police force.
What, she was his daughter? Wow, okay. That's a connection.
So when I'm in Birmingham police station, I said, what am I doing here? And one of them said, "Fucking virgin's out of season." So I thought it was over there. Anyway, they got me in the car and they took me back to London. But they never took me to Scotland Yard. They took me to a place called Tintagel House on the other side of the embankment.
Mm-hmm.
You know where the House of Parliament are? Mm-hmm. Facing the House of Parliament.
Oh, yeah.
There's a place called Tintagel House. And took me up there. And I went into this room, and what I noticed was, say, behind us is a blank wall. There were pictures of all the firm there, pictures of the twins, pictures of McVitie, of Cornell. And so consequently, I knew something was serious. And so Nipper Reed said to me, "Chris, we know you didn't have nothing to do with it, and we know you left. Would you like to tell us about it?" "We promise you nor none of your family will be arrested. We want to know. We want to know what you know. And we know you left, but we know something happened. Did you go to a party in Everin Road?" I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." They said, "We've got the craze. We've got their firm. And a lot of their firm are on our side. Now tell us about it." I said, "I can't tell you what I don't know. I have not been to any party." Because that's my education, from approved school to Borstal to detention centre to prison. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You don't say nothing. That was a culture of the East End. You don't say nothing. You know, and that way you can't drop yourself in it. And so consequently, he turned round, he said, look, after the interview, he said, there's my card. Think about it, give me a call. I mean, the man was trying to to get me out of it. You understand what I'm saying? But I couldn't do it. So anyway, the outcome of it all was I left Tintagel House and caught a cab and went home. And I thought, well, I've got to let Violet know what's going on. The crazed mum.
Yeah.
So I went to Bunhill Row where they lived and knocked on the door, and Violet came at the door with a girl called Carol, who was Reggie's girlfriend. And I said, Violet, I said, I need to speak to you. Come in, Chris, nice to see you and everything else. And I said, look, the police have brought me down from Birmingham. They've taken me to a place called Tintagel House, and they've got photographs of the twins and all the firm, certain people who have been done and what have you. Would you let the twins know what I've seen and what I've told you? I said, and, you know, wish him luck. Anyway, I've gone to walk out, and she said, Chris, please, everybody's deserting them. Please help them. I said, I can't, Violet. I cannot go. Please, she said, we're going up there in an hour's two's time. Would you come with us? I said, no. And I looked at her and I saw my own mother. A mother who cared about her sons. And she felt they had no friends. Everybody had left them and deserted them. And to all intents and purposes, Ben, that is exactly what happened.
They'd started to just abandon them.
Abandon them, yeah. Because a lot of people didn't like them. They suffered them. But they didn't, you know, they were seen as stroke pullers. They were seen as people that had done nasty things and everything else like that.
Stroke pullers, did you say?
Yeah, stroke pullers.
What does that mean?
Well, stroke means you pull a stroke. I mean, if somebody goes out and have a robbery and they find out about it, they go and they pull a stroke. We want our share.
Right.
You understand me?
Yeah.
So they weren't loved in the East End. So if there'd be anything else, they wanted a share of what other people had had. Mm. And so at the end of the day, you know, they paid for it all themselves. And so reluctantly, I went to the, crazy it seems, I listened to Violet, I went to Brixton. And as soon as I walked in, Charlie Cray saw me and he went, you shouldn't be here, Chris. You should not be here. I knew that, but tell that to a mother who thinks that her boys have got not a friend in the world. And so I went and saw him and I said, look, this is what's happened. You know, I've seen this, it's on the wall, and it looks to me like they've got quite a bit against you. So, you know what you're dealing with. You're up against it. Thanks for coming, Chris. You're one of the few who've even made any effort. And I said, well, I did it for your mum. Because she's kind of, you know, broken about everything. And so I left there, and I can still remember that poor lady, she had a handkerchief in her hand, wiping the tears from her eyes. And so did old Charlie, you understand? These are parents, they're going through it alone. They haven't got masses of people around them. It ain't the mafia. It's just a mum and dad. Anyway, I left them and I went back to Birmingham. I was up there maybe 2 weeks and the police came for me again. They brought me down to Tadjoy House. Nipper Reed was sitting there and he said, I gave you my card. Why didn't you get in touch with me? There's nothing I can tell you. He said, why did you go to Brixton? I said, I went to say hello to Christ. He said, you want to be part of them? I said, no. I said, I don't want to be part of anybody. Then tell us. I said, I can't tell you what I don't know. I was at no party. I don't know what you're talking about. And he was sitting behind a desk, like the old school teacher's desk, playing with a gun.
A gun?
Yeah, a pistol, and he come round and smacked me over the head with it. And I thought, you're just doing that to get a reaction out of me. I ain't going to react to this, because I know if I react, you've got me for something. Mm. And he turned round and said, you want to be with him? You're going to be with him. Charge him with murder. To Inspector Cater. And Cater said, murder? He said, yeah, charge him. And that's what they did. They charged me with murder. Took me to Bow Street Magistrates Court, put me in a cell. I heard some people talking, and one of them was Ronnie Bender. And then my brother Tony. So although the Cray firm had been nicked previous to that, me, Ronnie Bender and Tony, they had not arrested. And we were arrested, and we appeared in front of Bow Street Magistrates Court. There was Ronnie, Reggie, Charlie, Tony, Ronnie Bender, myself, Connie Whitehead, and Johnny Barry, or one of the Barry brothers. And surprised me, he was a guy called Freddie Foreman. I'd never met him before. Mm. And I thought, well, what's he doing here? So there were more people getting involved that had no part in it all. Mm. And that's what this is what I'm talking about, total chaos, total chaos. Anyway, we went before one of the longest murder trials in criminal history. They joined two murder trials together. They joined the McVitie murder and the Cornell murder. So Ian Barry, who had nothing at all to do with the McVitie murder, sat in the same dock as us on the Cornell murder. And we, who had no dealings or knew anything about the Cornell murder, sat in the dock through the Cornell murder.
So you were kind of collateral damage to the
phrase. Right. Being, that's right. That's what it was all about. Mm. And I'm pleased you recognise that, Ben. So what happened then was, there were differences, insults being thrown by Ronnie Cray at the prosecution barrister. And I can remember, you know, they want to put numbers around our neck like we were cattle. And we ripped them all up and threw them down on the floor. Because, you know, it weren't the Nuremberg trial. Mm. Why should we stand there with numbers on? We'd not been convicted. We'd not been found guilty.
But were you expecting how did it work back then? As in, were you expecting the twins to say, no, he had nothing to do with it?
I think that's what we expected. I don't know that we expected that. But what we expected, I suppose, was them to have an answer, to have a plan B. They didn't have anything. Mm. They had nothing. And they said to Albert Donoghue, apparently, who turned against them, well, you'll take that murder case and you'll take the Cornell, you'll take the McVitie to Ronnie Hart, and all these people turned against them. Mm. You understand what I mean? That was their get-out plan. It weren't to get anybody else out. If they were going to go down, everybody else was going to go down with them. You'd have thought that they'd have done something, but they didn't. Mm. Because they needed the firm, or a firm. So anyway, the Cornell murder comes up. The two are there, so they give the evidence for the Cornell murder. And this young woman got in the dock, the barmaid, the blind beggar. It's like listening to an angel speak, clear, precise, but slightly intimidated, protective of her children. You know, everything she saw was as clear as a bell, you understand? Mm. And so she convicted every one of us. Although she did not give evidence in the McVitie murder, it was nothing to do with her. It didn't happen even remotely near the separation of the time and everything else like that. But she, when she got in that dock, That was it. Forget about Ronnie Hart and Albert Donoghue. They were all ex-crims, ex-firms. You understand what I mean? They were trying to get themselves out of it and all the rest of it. And we all went down. And
you went down for murder?
I went down for murder, yeah. It's got right. 15 years.
How did that feel?
My brother Tony went down for 15 years. Ronnie Bender got 20 years.
Why did Ronnie Bender get more than you?
Because they said he was more involved.
So how did that...
Remember, I've not done that.
Yeah, yeah.
You understand?
But how did it feel knowing that you and your brother were going down for something that you didn't do?
I'll tell you what it felt like. It felt like being stood against a wall and you've got rifles pointing at you and you're going down. I felt like them men who stood in front of a German firing squad.
Mm.
I knew what it felt like. Hopeless. Destroyed. Yet there was always a glimmer of hope. There was always a glimmer that they might do something. Never ever did.
So how did you manage through that time? How did you keep yourself sane?
Sane. Initially fighting the system. Fighting the system. I finished up in Parkhurst Hospital, badly beaten up. I asked for it. I mean, I went...
By the guards of the...
Yeah, no, by the prison officers.
Yeah.
What happened was, I went in the dining room this day because the food was atrocious.
Mm.
Conditions were not nice. You wanted your, like, your soap and your shampoo and stuff like that. And you had to wait to get it and all that kind of thing. I needed it now. I didn't need it next week or whatever.
Mm.
And so I was kicking against the system right, left and centre. And we decided to have a sit-in. And we locked the cell up, about six of us in there. And one turned around and said, I need to go to the toilet. And he went, and he didn't come back. Then another one went down. Another one went down, none of them come back. And a good friend of mine, Freddie Sanson, he said, Chris, he said, I'm going to go down this, I'm going to find out what's happened. And I could hear fighting and yelling and screaming. And I went down, I got stuck in with Freddie. And there were that many, they pulled us down to the ground, but they didn't touch me. They didn't kick me, they didn't hit me with a stick or anything else. They literally pulled me down and they carried me down the chokey block, as they did Freddie, and they threw me in a cell. The next morning, I remember that night, the banging on the doors of the chokey cells. It was like the drums of Hades could be heard all over the island. And we were all full of rage and anger. And in the morning, Freddie Sanson came out of his door. He threw a piss pot over the screws. And I could hear bang, 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 bang. And I knew they'd done him. Then little Ray Powell, on the next cell to me, he came out, he did the same. Bum, 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 bang, bang, bang. And he got a kick in. I'm the last on the block. I can stay in the cell and not come out. Or I can be with my friends. I can do what they've done. I want to look them in the eye. And I went out and did the same. They pulled me down. I got stuck into them. They gave me a thorough beating. And I remember it was black and blue. And chucked me in the cell. And in the morning, the chief came round. And he said, stand up, Lumbriano. And he said, the governor's here. Man's name was Gilbert Footer. And he came in and he went, what's happened to you? I said, like, you don't know what's happened. You know exactly what's happened. I said, but come on, let's finish it off. Come on, finish it off. You can't hurt me anymore. I'm beyond hurt. I won't raise a fist. Come on, finish it off. He said, no, you're going to Parkhurst Hospital. And I said, No, I'm not. They said, we're sent for an ambulance and a stretcher.
Wow. So you were really badly beaten.
Yeah, I said, no, I'm going to walk. And that's what I did, because I wanted to look at all them screws that done me, and I wanted you to think, yeah, you know about it, didn't you?
Mm.
But you ain't beat me. You've hurt me, but you haven't beat me. I remember walking and getting in the prison van, took me to Parkhurst Hospital. The Queen's doctor was one of the doctors on the island, and he came in and he looked at me, and I'd broken a cheekbone and different things like that, and lost a couple of teeth. And he turned around and said, look, you're going to have to rest up and take it easy. And there was a screw there called Comfer, a senior officer, and he came in and he said, look, he said, you'd be better off in Broadmoor. He said, they get visits whenever they want. There's women there, you can dance and all the rest of it, and food's good. What don't you think about going over there? I said, no. I said, I'm angry, but I'm not mad. And anyway, I did the 2 weeks there. I went over to Albany on the Isle of Wight, and I got back into the cell, and everybody's going, we won, we won, we won. And these screws came and said to me, get yourself together. You're being moved. Next thing I knew, I was up in Hull prison. They moved me away. Didn't win nothing.
Mm.
Didn't win nothing. Battered, bruised, hurt. I didn't care. I was beyond pain. The pain I had was inside of me. You understand, physical pain didn't do nothing. It was a relief more than anything else from the pain that was deep, deep, deep. The loss of my daughter, a young baby. I'm not allowed to see her. I'm not allowed to hold her. But I've done it. Nobody else has done this. Did I need to get a kick in? No, I chose to get a kick in. I chose to throw a piss pot over the screws. You understand what I mean? And if I'd have had that done to me, I'd want to do the same as they did to me. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
That's the real world. You can't go blaming it, Tom, Dick and Harry. You've got to accept responsibility for everything you've done. So the first half of my life, I accept total responsibility, and I paid for everything in one go. All the bad stuff I done, that 15 years wiped the slate clean. But it didn't, because inside of me was this person who kind of, I knew I was better than that. I knew there was somebody decent inside of me. I'd come from decent parents, you know, believers, people of conviction. And I remember I was about 7 years into the sentence, and a guy called Stuart Brown, a mate of mine, Scotch guy, he gave me a load of books. And I put them under the bed. And this night, I just couldn't handle it anymore. Ben, the blood was running cold and hot through my veins. And a voice was saying, kill yourself. You're never going to get out. This is it. This is as far as you can go. You've done 7 years. Look back. Now look forward. What is there? You've got absolutely nothing. It's a wasteland. You have run through your life. You've decimated everything that's been decent in it. You've done it. Nobody else. End it. And if a screw had walked in that door, I might have tried to justify being there. Thank God nobody did. So I thought, you can't think like this. This raging blood, this anger, this pain, this deep down madness. And I went through these books. I got them out, crime, you know, people's life stories and all the rest of it. And there was a Bible. And I picked it up and I threw it away. Only time I'd ever had a Bible was when I ripped a page out. Being a Catholic, they don't give you a Bible, they tell you what to think.
Mm-hmm.
Never had it in my life. But I had had it, and I ripped pages out and rolled cigarettes up because the paper's very, very thin.
Mm.
And so, although I hadn't read it, I smoked it. And so, you know, I thought, no. And I went through the books again and I went and picked the Bible up and I thought, people have climbed mountains. People have overcome tremendous burdens and pain and they've survived. And this book they've stood on, can I get anything from it? And I thought, if I lay down and I put it under my pillow, the good thoughts will go into my head. And I'd read many, many stories of people that were desolate, were lost, were broken, and they'd met this man, Jesus. But I didn't think anything like that could ever happen to me. It happened to them, not for me, though. And nothing happened. And so I remember, it's now about 4 o'clock in the morning, 4:30. I'm tired. I just don't know nothing. I've got this rage. And I took the book and I put it there.
By your heart?
By my heart. And the world changed that day. I fell asleep and I woke up. I got the Bible and I put it down the front of my trousers. I needed that book wherever I went. And if anybody had asked me, what are you doing with that book? Why have you got that book down your trousers? I could say, well, in case anybody comes at me with a knife.
Mm.
I've got that there as protection. It was nothing like that at all. It was something deeper.
The final thing I want to ask you is, you know, you've had a very unique life.
Yeah.
What's it taught you? You know, what's your big life lesson that you've learned?
In the darkness, there is always a light. You know, if you want to do something, plant a tree. You can sit underneath it in the shade. You can watch it grow and develop. You can show it love and care. And while you're doing that, you're also receiving it. What you give in this world is what you get. And I can remember a dream I had, and the dream was, I was in a garden, and the garden was my life. And I'd run through that garden. I pulled up the flowers, the plants, the bushes, the trees, and destroyed them all. I decimated it. That was my life. The people that loved me, the people that cared, the people I trusted, the people, you know, trusted me and had belief in me. I destroyed it all. Well, now I've got my garden back again. I've got some lovely things in it. I've got my disappointments, but, you know, I can deal with them because instead of judging people, you judge yourself. Could I have done something good there? Could I have helped that person? It's not always about me. It's about us. Collectively, we can do something. We can do it on our own. But it's so good when we all come together. We all need each other. God bless.
Great message. Thanks so much for your time, yeah. Chris.
And you, Ben. Thank you.
Brilliant.
Yeah, I couldn't have done it with anybody else better.
Lovely to hear.
You allowed me to speak.